Since we had the chance to go over the test answers in lecture today, I want to take this time here to go over a topic that's going to help us for when we get back next week. Since we haven't completed the Group A cations yet, I'm going to give you that chance over the long break to prepare the pre-lab for the Group B cations. So we'll have that discussion next time, as is would be normally scheduled. Today I want to talk about formal charge versus oxidation state, which I know is something that I've talked about out loud before, but I did go back and review the notes, and it didn't look like I had written anything formally down. And since we're just about to get to electrochemistry, which involves a lot of redox reactions, we do need to be able to calculate oxidation states, and I do want you to know the difference between an oxidation state and a formal charge. So I know that some of what I'm going to say here initially has come up a few times in the quarter, but it's not a bad idea sometimes to review basic principles. So we've talked several times about covalent versus ionic bonding. Just to humor me, could someone tell me the difference between what a covalent bond is and an ionic bond? Anyone? Covalent share electrons versus what would happen in an ionic bond. So you have a transfer electron. So in something like sodium chloride, we imagine that the sodium gives up its electron to chlorine. The sodium becomes positively charged as a result of that. The chlorine becomes negatively charged. Opposite charges attract, and so that's what brings the two atoms together. Versus something like hydrogen, which is where you have two atoms where they have a true covalent bond, sharing those electrons between the two nuclei, and that kind of acts like the glue, the negatively charged glue that holds the two positive charged nuclei together. So what kind of bond do we have in a molecule like water? The oxygen-hydrogen bond in water, what kind of bond would we call it? All right, it's a covalent bond, and yes, we do call it a type of covalent bond, but it's not a true covalent bond, is it? In the sense that the electrons are not evenly shared. Why not? Yes. Because oxygen is more electronegative, which means that it is a greedy, it likes to draw electrons and bonds to itself. So if it's not 100% covalent, would it act a little bit like it's ionic? Because in ionic bonds, we have a displacement of charge. In this type of covalent bond, we also have a displacement of charge. And in fact, it's something that we call a polar covalent bond. What does polar mean? Now, that's a term that's already come up this quarter. What does polar mean? So you have some kind of charge separation. So polar covalent means this imbalanced kind of covalent bond. But again, if we're trying to figure out exactly how many electrons there are in the molecule water, like let's say we wanted to say exactly how many electrons there are on hydrogen versus exactly how many electrons there are in oxygen, should we consider that bond to be completely covalent? Meaning that we'll imagine that one electron from that bond is on hydrogen, one electron of that bond is on oxygen. Or instead, should we acknowledge the fact that oxygen is more electronegative, and should we take both of the electrons in that bond and let oxygen have it instead? Which one do we do? The answer is yes. Which, you're not used to that answer. In organic chemistry, they'll give me that answer right away, or when I teach Chem 1A, because particularly in Chem 1A, where you have quantum mechanics as a topic, you're talking about things like photons, which are these supposed particles of light, except light is something that acts like a wave, except yes, it does act like a photon, so it's a particle and it's a wave and it's both and it's neither. So that's why there I would ask, is this a particle or wave? And the answer is yes. Do we treat the bond as covalent or ionic? Yes. We do both, in fact. We have these two different counting systems, one of them formal charge, which is where we do consider all bonds to be completely covalent. And then we've got oxidation state, where we consider things to be ionic. And that's where I want to talk about today, because I've mentioned this much so far, but now I want to get into how do we do the counting. So because I hadn't written this first part down, it looks like, in the past, though, Let me talk a little bit about this situation with water. So recall that before, when we've talked about water, I probably used this kind of sign to show that there is an imbalance of charge. And this bond is very polar due to the difference in electronegativity between oxygen and hydrogen. And as I've done in the past in the quarter, I'm going to abbreviate electronegativity throughout the rest of this discussion with EN. Now, as I said, because this bond is polar, it's not truly covalent, and yet there is some sharing of electrons, so it's not truly ionic either. The point of bringing water back up again is to then ask, how do we treat these bonds if we're trying to count electrons? The question being, should the bond be considered covalent or ionic? And the answer is yes. Which means that both points of view are going to be taken. So first, let's talk about formal charge, because that's the easier case. Because when we're talking about formal charge, all of the bonds, we break evenly, regardless of what kinds of electrons or what kinds of atoms are involved in those bonds. So we ignore any differences there may be in electronegativity. So formal charge is an electron counting system. In which all bonds are treated as completely covalent. There is a formula that you likely learned back in Chem 1A, but before we get to the formula, I want to show you the systematic approach to determining these formal charges. The reason being is that we'll need to do that same kind of approach for oxidation state, because oxidation state does not have an easy formula. And for those of you who are going to go on to organic chemistry, which, out of curiosity, how many of you are going to be taking organic chemistry? Well, a large number of you. So if you did learn rules for oxidation states back in 1A, you might know there is no rule for carbon because there are 9 different oxidation states for carbon. And you'll see why in just a few moments, why there is no particular rule for carbon. But we're focusing on formal charge at the moment. I'm going to use an organic molecule as my example for demonstrating the difference between oxidation state and formal charge. This is the molecule hydroxyacetone, just a common molecule, a small organic molecule. Organic meaning that it's carbon-containing does not necessarily mean that it's something that came from a biological source. So it does not have to be something that's necessarily naturally occurring. Where the O and the H is on the right-hand side, if I replace those two atoms with just an H, then that would be the molecule acetone, which is a very, very, very common organic solvent, a very inexpensive solvent as well. Suppose we wanted to break this apart to calculate formal charge. We're going to imagine that all the bonds break evenly. So I'm going to draw lines through the middle of each of these bonds. Not that in real life they're actually breaking. This is just a thought process for coming up with where the electrons are located. But there is, in real life, a bond-breaking, what's called mechanism, a way that electrons move. There is a common step in which the two electrons in one bond do end up split between two different atoms. So that kind of even bond breaking if it really happened as part of a chemical reaction, that is known as homolysis. Homo meaning same, lysis meaning to cut. So these are cut in the same way, meaning that they have the same number of electrons that move two different directions, one to one atom, one to another. I'm going to draw what you could say are miniature Lewis dot structures for just the atoms. So they're atomic Lewis dot structures, because we have broken all the bonds. And I will try to draw this in a way that it's clear. For each of the hydrogens, if you notice, all the hydrogens only had one bond each to start with. So if that bond breaks evenly, that means each hydrogen is going to end up with one electron on it. Wherever hydrogen had been attached, that means there's one electron on that atom as well. Between the carbon-carbon bonds, there'd be one electron that would go to each carbon from each bond. On the right-hand side, that carbon-oxygen single bond, one electron for each of those. The carbon-oxygen double bond, since it's a double bond, that means two pairs of electrons. So two electrons go one direction. You could say one from each pair. And two electrons go the other direction. On oxygen, there were electrons to begin with. Lone electrons, they're called. Lone because they're not shared with other atoms. And so now I've placed all the electrons around the atoms of that molecule. What is the calculation that we do for formal charge? What is the counting that's being done? It's comparing how many valence electrons these atoms would normally have in their unreacted elemental forms, comparing that to how many electrons they really have. Let's imagine, let's say, oxygen that is acting as an oxidizing agent, so that it ends up in a compound like this. Oxidation state. Well, in this case, oxygen has ended up where it has six electrons by this counting system. Now, how many electrons would oxygen normally have in its unreacted elemental state? How could we even figure that out? How many valence electrons does oxygen have? Let me ask a related question. What is the electron configuration for oxygen? Periodic table, maybe some of you can't see it. It is over here. And that's the answer, by the way. We use the periodic table. Because from left to right, if we look only at the main group elements, those in the first two columns of the periodic table, those in the last six, are what are known as the S block and the P block. Well, if you count how many columns over that you are, that's how many valence electrons that you have. So oxygen, being in the sixth column of that main group set of elements, has six valence electrons. Over here, the way that we've split this compound apart, it also has six electrons there. That means it hasn't effectively gained or lost any electrons, which is why it's considered to have a zero formal charge. And that's, let me write down that formula, and then we'll solve for what the formal charges are for all these different atoms. Formal charge, Fc, is equal to the number of, I'll call them standard valence electrons. And that means for the unreacted element. And again, we can determine that by looking at its position on the periodic table. And we compare that to the number of electrons actually present. You can remember which way to write the formula because suppose, and this is what I was about to say earlier, suppose you had some kind of reaction where oxygen ended up gaining electrons. Then if you ended up with 7 electrons on oxygen somehow versus the 6 that you started with, well, that should be a negatively charged atom because it's got extra electrons. So 6, the number it should have, 7 that it really has, that means the formula is designed correctly because it gives us that negative charge. Let's look at the hydrogens and the oxygens because all the hydrogens look the same, all the oxygens look the same, all the carbons look the same. For hydrogen, it's supposed to have 1 valence electron, given that it's in that first column of the periodic table. There is 1 electron present the way that we counted it, so that means it has a formal charge of 0. If we look at oxygen, oxygen supposed to have 6. It does have 6. It's also got a formal charge of 0. And then carbon, it's supposed to have 4. It does have 4. It's got a formal charge of 0. So all of the atoms in this have a formal charge of 0, which is exactly what we expect because when I drew the structure here, I didn't put any pluses or minuses on it. Because if I had, it would be because they had a formal charge because Lewis dot structures are written on the basis that there are covalent bonds. Formal charge is the counting system that we assume everything has covalent bonds, and therefore we use formal charge when writing Lewis dot structures. Let me write that last bit I said down. One more time, because Lewis dot structures are assuming that you have a covalent bonding model. That's why we draw the lines connecting the different atoms. Then we use formal charge to annotate those structures because that's the type of counting system we use if we have covalent bonds. Notice something else that's happened here. Because all of the atoms end up being formal charge of 0, if you add up all the zeros, you get 0. Which also should make sense because the molecule as a whole has no charge, and that's another rule. The sum of individual formal charges must equal the overall charge of the molecule. Now, if we re-examine that example molecule, and you notice that all the oxygens do end up with the same number of electrons, all the carbons do, all the hydrogens do in this case, part of the reason is because the way that the bonds are being broken is predictable. Each bond gives 1 electron to each atom. So if we wanted to count the number of electrons present, instead of having to go through this whole disconnection process, we could look at an atom and say, oh, there's four bonds there. That means it's going to have four electrons. So the number of electrons coming from bonds, in other words, is equal to the number of bonds. In the future, you might talk about bonds that are distributed, meaning they're across more than one atom. So to be more safe, we could word it as this way, that it is half the number of bonding electrons. But since for most cases of what you're going to see, a bond is two electrons, then half of two is one. Of course, then we have things like oxygen that have electrons around them already. So if we're counting electrons, then we would just count those lone electrons automatically as part of that atom. So in other words, I'm going to rewrite this formula where I said that the formal charge is the number of standard valence electrons minus the number of electrons present. And I'm suggesting that the safer way to reword this is to say that the formal charge is equal to the number of those valence electrons, the standard number, minus a combination of the number of lone electrons, the electrons that belong just to that particular atom, along with half of the number of bonding electrons. But in most cases, because you're going to have structures where a bond just consists of two electrons, then here's the way that you probably have seen this formula before. Number of valence electrons minus number of lone electrons minus number of bonds. And we'll do just a very small example of applying that to a common molecule. This is the nitrite molecule, which hopefully from memorizing your names and structures back in Chem 1A, you recall that this is a negative 1 charged ion. So there better be a total of negative 1 across the formal charges that are here. Let's see if we can calculate what those formal charges are. For the left-hand oxygen, we've established how many electrons oxygen should have in its unreacted elemental state, which is how many? 6. How many lone electrons does that oxygen have? 4. 2 lone pairs, but we're counting electrons individually. So it's a total of 4 lone electrons. How many bonds does that oxygen have? 2. A double bond, but that counts twice then. That means the formal charge ends up being 0. What about the nitrogen? How many valence electrons should it have? 5. How many lone electrons does it have? 2. And how many bonds? 3. So 5 minus 2 minus 3 is also 0. That better mean that that last oxygen ends up with a negative 1 on it, which it will. Because if we calculate its formal charge, then we get 6, the number it's supposed to have. 6, the number it has as lone electrons, plus it's got a bond, so subtracting 1 or more from that, we get negative 1. So if I had drawn this molecule as a structure, then yes, I really should put a negative charge by that oxygen. Now, does anyone have any questions on formal charge? Because what we really need to be discussing now is oxidation state, because that's what we use in redox reactions. So let's start with a definition for oxidation state like I did for formal charge. It's going to look very similar because it's still a type of counting system. Oxidation state is an electron counting system in which all bonds are treated as completely ionic. There is an exception to that, which is if we have something like the molecule hydrogen, H2. If you have two atoms that are the same type in one bond, well, they don't have a difference in electronegativity. If there's no difference in electronegativity, the idea here being that you give the electrons to the more electronegative element, well, you can't do it because there isn't one. And so then we fall back to treating that bond as if it is a covalent bond, which means when we're counting up electrons, in that case, we go back to assuming one electron goes to one atom, one electron goes to another. You'll see how that comes up in one of the common oxidation state rules that you probably memorized back in Chem 1A. So an oxidation state is an electron counting system in which all bonds are treated as completely ionic unless the bond is composed of two of the same atom. Now, what does it mean that we treat all the bonds as ionic? As I said just a moment ago, the electrons in each bond are given to the more electronegative element in that bond. So let's take that same organic molecule I used as an example, and let's break everything apart now following electronegativity. Now, homolysis was the term meaning that a bond breaks evenly. Here, the term to mean that bonds, with the exception of having two of the same atom, that bonds break unevenly is known as heterolysis. Hetero meaning different, lysis meaning cut. So the bond is cut unevenly, in other words. The drawing might end up looking a little strange, because what I'm going to essentially do is to corral off the electrons that belong to different atoms. For example, if we look at oxygen versus carbon, oxygen is the second most electronegative element on the periodic table, fluorine being number one. Everything else in this molecule is less electronegative than carbon then, and so if I look at either of the oxygens, I know that it's going to own, we could say, all of the electrons in that bond. So the curved line I'm drawing there is just trying to show that, yes, oxygen is going to end up possessing those for the purposes of counting. Same thing is going to happen both with the carbon and the hydrogen that are attached to the other oxygen, because, again, they're both less electronegative than oxygen. Now, between carbon and hydrogen, that would be difficult for you to determine just by looking at the periodic table, because hydrogen, yes, is... Oh, well, before I say anything, let's do a spot check here. From left to right on the periodic table, is that an increase or decrease in electronegativity? I couldn't quite hear that. Increase. As we go from the top of the periodic table down to the bottom, is that an increase or decrease in electronegativity? Decrease, because fluorine is the most electronegative element. So from the bottom here, francium, as we go up to fluorine, we're increasing in electronegativity. If you look at hydrogen versus carbon, hydrogen is left, which means it should be less electronegative. And then hydrogen is up, which means it should be more electronegative. So which one is it, though? Because it's both. Turns out in this case that hydrogen is less electronegative than carbon is, which there is a table that we use to determine that. There is a mnemonic device that a former instructor used to use for this as well, Fonkel Brickship, which doesn't mean anything, but if you can remember the syllables, Fon, F-O-N, Coal, C-L, Brick, B-R-I, you know, like that, to remember the elements. Just as a practical basis, you should know that fluorine, oxygen, and nitrogen are, in order, the three most electronegative elements. That's somewhat useful knowledge. The rest of it, like I said, we can look up on a table. Coming back to this problem, if hydrogen is less electronegative than carbon, then I'm going to draw these little fences in this way for each of those hydrogens. Now, the last thing we got to do is to break the carbon-carbon bonds. Here, we got to go back to doing it evenly because they're the same electronegativity. So let's see what this mess looks like after we break it apart. What you're going to find is that both of the oxygens end up with 8 electrons. You're going to find that all of the hydrogens end up bare, without any electrons, because they're less electronegative than either the carbon or the oxygen. So they end up with nothing. The carbons end up with differing numbers. The carbon on the left, because it was hooked up to 3 hydrogens, ends up with 7 electrons around it. The carbon in the middle, because it had a double bond with oxygen, only ends up with 2 electrons. Then the carbon on the right, it's got a mixture of being hooked up to oxygen versus hydrogen versus carbon, so it ends up with 5 electrons. And here's exactly the point I was making earlier about carbon. Carbon's oxidation state entirely depends on what is hooked up to it. So there is a formula of a type, which there's no point in presenting it here. It's more appropriate for organic class. But otherwise, the easiest way is to just analyze it like this. Now, let's go ahead and determine the oxidation states, because even though there's not one good formula because of this variability in what could be attached, still, we can define what this comparison should be to come up with a number for oxidation state. And it is still how many electrons it has, how many valence it has, electrons it has in its unreacted elemental state, versus how many electrons we think that it has by doing this counting system. So, oxidation state is again equal to number of standard valence electrons minus number of electrons present. So we look at each hydrogen. Each hydrogen is supposed to have 1, but it doesn't have any, which means it's going to have a +1 oxidation state. Both oxygens happen to be the same. They both are such that compared to the 6 electrons they have in unreacted oxygen, they have 8 instead, so they both have a -2 oxidation state. In just a moment, we're going to talk about some of the common oxidation state rules, and one of them is that hydrogen's usually +1. Another one of them is that oxygen's usually -2. And the reason is hydrogen's usually less electronegative than everything else, and oxygen's usually more electronegative than everything else. And so that helps explain the rule. We're then going to come to where do these exceptions come from? Because the way that I present the rules to 1A, because I don't like the rules, they're useful, but they're useful as shortcuts. This is really what oxidation state is. But I tell the 1A students that hydrogen is +1 except when it's -1 except when it's 0. And then oxygen is -2 except when it's -1 except when it's 0. And chlorine is -1 except when it's not. Which makes the rules sound silly, but that's exactly what the rules are. But that's why we're going through this big, long process to help understand the rules. And then we will do a little bit of practical at the end here, where we figure out what the oxidation state of something else is. But let me finish off then with these carbons, because there are three of them. One carbon here that has 7 electrons means it's got a -3 oxidation state. The other carbon over here that has 5 electrons, that means it has a -1 oxidation state. And the carbon double bound to oxygen, because it's only got its 2 electrons, has got a +2 oxidation state. So if we take the 6 hydrogens, multiply by +1, if we take that +2 oxidation state on that central carbon, that adds up to +8 in total. Then if we take the carbon that's -3, the carbon that's -1, and then the 2 oxygens that are -2. -3 plus -2 plus -2 plus -1 is -8. So the overall +8 and -8, they add up to 0, which is exactly what we expect. Why? Because this is the same molecule that we had in the previous example that still has the same overall charge of 0. Oxidation state and formal charges are just ways of counting electrons, but the total number of electrons is still the same. So individual oxidation state and formal charge numbers may change, but that total is not going to change. And so this has the same rule that the sum of oxidation states must also equal the overall charge of the molecule. Which means the total of oxidation states is the total of formal charges, is that overall molecular charge, because again, the two systems are just ways of distributing electrons, but the total number of electrons is still the same. Now, let's see what some of these oxidation state rules are. And let me just ask, because I'd asked the morning section as well, how many of you have already in the past done balancing of redox reactions? Okay, a handful of you, but not everybody. So that's fine. We're leading up to that by reviewing what oxidation states are. But then at the end here, like I said, we're going to do something practical because that's going to be useful in balancing redox reactions. Hydrogen, the rule is that it's +1, except in a type of compound known as a metal hydride. And in that case, that it is -1. In fact, that's what hydride means, H-. That I-D-E ending, think chloride, bromide, that's where also that means -1. So hydride, -1 hydrogen. The reason for this, I had mentioned earlier, is that hydrogen is usually less electronegative than anything else it's attached to. The notable exception is with many different metals that it might end up attached to. So again, we're referring back to the periodic table. If we compare hydrogen to, let's say, sodium or potassium, because they're directly in the same column, we can compare them. Hydrogen being up on the periodic table is more electronegative than sodium or potassium. But it turns out that sodium hydride and potassium hydride are perfectly isolatable compounds. They're useful reagents. So those are compounds in which hydrogen is going to be -1. Now, there's a rule that let me slip in here, because that compound, sodium hydride, acts somewhat like it's an ionic compound. And if the hydrogen were an ion, let's say, then how would we count its oxidation state? Because there are no bonds there. Well, we'd count it the same way as formal charge because there are no bonds there. So in other words, if all you have is an individual atom, its oxidation state is its formal charge. So it is a rule, maybe just out of order, that for monatomic ions, ions of only one atom, that's what monatomic means, the formal charge is equal to the oxidation state because there are no bonds. And to highlight just one more time, having no bonds means there's no difference in counting, because that's where the difference in counting comes from, what to do with bonds. Let's look at the rule for oxygen. Oxygen is negative 2, except, well, let's see if anybody remembers. When is oxygen not negative 2? When it is paired with fluorine, or? Anybody remember the word peroxide? We'll see what a peroxide is in just a moment, but that's where the exception comes from, that oxygen is negative 2 except in peroxides. Here is the structure of a peroxide. It is one in which we have an oxygen-oxygen single bond. So, if we're doing oxidation state where we're supposed to treat things as ionic bonds, we run into the problem where we have two oxygens being the same connected through a bond. So if we're doing this formal process of cutting bonds up, we would put a line straight through that bond. But then oxygen is more electronegative than either of those hydrogens. So we get both electrons from each of those bonds. And so this is what the molecule would end up looking like. Not that this is the way it reacts, this is just the way we're counting electrons. Well, each oxygen has 7 electrons instead of the 6 it would have as an unreacted element, but it doesn't have 8 like oxygen usually would, and that's because oxygen's connected with itself. So this is the source of that rule, that oxygen is negative 2, unless you have a peroxide, and because it's a peroxide, then it's automatically negative 1. There is the rarer exception, but it does happen for that few set of molecules, when oxygen and fluorine are connected to each other. Fluorine is more electronegative than oxygen, so it will also trump this rule. Now, there are a few other common rules, but let's see an example of how we would use one. Let's try to determine the oxidation state for sulfur in this compound sulfurous acid. So, in order to tackle these problems, you have to make some educated guesses or assumptions. You might remember for oxoacids, acids that are generated by a central atom being connected to oxygen, then, well, oxygen is going to be the more electronegative element, and so it is going to fall back to having its normal negative 2 charge. And generally, if we did have a peroxide in a structure, we would try to show that somehow in its formula. So unless you see on purpose a double O written or some other way of showing O2, you can assume that oxygen's only got one connection to that central atom. There's not oxygens being connected to each other. So again, we can presume that oxygen is in its negative 2 oxidation state. Hopefully, in this case, you recognize sulfite as a polyatomic ion, which means hydrogen is a counter ion. It is an ion. And remember, for ions, oxidation state is the same as formal charge. So hydrogen is going to be plus 1, and oxygen following its normal rule is going to be minus 2. Notice I didn't write this down as plus 2 and minus 6, because I know there are two hydrogens there. I know there's three oxygens, but if and when I ask for oxidation state, it's going to be per atom. So each oxygen has a negative 2 oxidation state. Each hydrogen has a plus 1 oxidation state. How can we use all of this to come up with sulfur's oxidation state? You have to add them all up and make them equal to 0, right? So let's come up with an expression. The total charge, which is 0, has to add up to whatever the oxidation state is on hydrogen, plus there's 1 sulfur, plus there's 3 oxygens. Each hydrogen is plus 1. We don't know what the sulfur is. That's what we're solving for. And each oxygen is negative 2. So we get 0 is equal to 2 plus S minus 6, which means S is equal to 4, which means sulfur has a plus 4 oxidation state. This is very common to the type of quick oxidation state problem you'll have to do when you balance redox reactions. You might be given something like dichromate. Oh, there's a good example. I should have done that one this morning. Sorry, morning section. Presuming that oxygen is its normal negative 2 oxidation state, what would be the oxidation state on chromium? Yes, which means you're quick at math. But how did you get to that answer? Well, let's do the same kind of formula. We have a negative 2 overall charge. There are 2 chromiums, and there are 7 oxygens. We're solving for chromium, so we don't know its charge or oxidation state yet. Each oxygen, though, is negative 2. That leaves us with negative 16 being equal to... I'm sorry, not negative 16. I can't do math. 12 being equal to 2 chromiums, which means each chromium is plus 6. Questions about oxidation states? So we're going to pick up with oxidation states as we do redox reactions next week. Let me really briefly summarize the lab procedure that you're doing one more time. I'll again acknowledge that there was the unintentional stress that was created by me not enforcing you to do your pre-lab. That's why I didn't want to do the pre-lab for the next experiment today. I wanted to give you the chance to read over it first, because the next pre-lab is quite a bit more complicated than this first set of ions. If any of you read ahead, you know there's quite a bit more tests. So please read up over that. That's not a please. You have to read up over it over the weekend or the long weekend, because you have a pre-lab due on Wednesday. But because we had not had a proper pre-lab before, and in case you haven't had a chance to read the procedure because you've been swamped with tests, we evil instructors always love giving tests right before a break, right? I'll go, I guess that's a slight bit better evil than to have them right after the break. I don't know. So the procedure is this. We have a potential for all different kinds of ions in a sample, which we're then doing a series of successive separations. The very first separation we did is to react a mixture with hydrochloric acid, because only 3 common ions fail to stay soluble in the presence of chloride. That's silver, mercury, and lead. All other ions would remain soluble, and in theory, if we had that multi-ion unknown sample, after doing the very first reaction with HCl, we would take the supernatant and save it for part B. In part B, the first thing you're going to do is react it with a solution of ammonia to bring the pH down to around 9. That's because some ions will precipitate in weakly basic conditions but remain soluble unless they are... Sorry. Some ions will precipitate in weakly basic solutions. Some ions will remain in solution unless they're strongly basic. And so we're going to be able to do another separation by first making the solution a little bit less, a little bit basic. So we go from acidic conditions to basic conditions. That's for part B, which is next time. Coming back to part A, after we reacted with HCl, we're supposed to have a precipitate. That precipitate, we're adding water to and removing that water at first. That's a process called a wash. And the reason we're doing that is in case there's anything unwanted that might have somehow come along for the ride, got stuck to that precipitate, that we want to get rid of so we don't get a false test, a false result. So you wash it a couple of times, then you heat it up in water. And the reason that you're heating it up is because out of those three potential chlorides, lead chloride is the most soluble. And if you follow the quantities that are in the lab procedure, you'll end up being able to dissolve the lead. Suppose that lead is the only ion that's in your sample. You go through that process and you still have a precipitate. Well, then that either means there really was something there that shouldn't have been, or maybe it just was the quantities were off and you have more precipitate than you're supposed to. But that's why you take the supernatant out of that mixture to test with the potassium iodide to really make sure that you got lead. Now, after you had heated up in water, assuming that you had all potential ions, yes, you then should have a precipitate, which you're then going to try to split apart using ammonia. Now, I had already told you that we don't have the mercury that is listed in the procedure, but we're still going to do all of the procedure as if we had mercury there, because it also tests indirectly for silver. And that's because to make sure that we have silver, we're going to try to dissolve it, because the ammonia will make a complex with that silver. It will make it soluble, which means we can separate it out from whatever other precipitate might be there. And then to make sure we have silver, we hit it with nitric acid, because that gets rid of the ammonia that would have been attached to it, and that causes it to precipitate out again. Now, as far as how you're doing this, this part, I apologize, I wasn't more clear on. There are different starting bottles over here that you can choose from. You do need to test silver. You do need to test lead. But there is also a combination silver-lead solution. The silver-lead solution is more fun, you could say, because it would represent more like the case that you would have, potentially, if you have a mixture of unknowns. It's also a better test to see if that flow chart, that separation procedure, really works or not. But we have the individual silver and lead solutions in case the combination doesn't work well, so that you can make sure that you're able to tell what the results are supposed to look like with just that one individual ion. Now, I didn't give you that guidance when you started before, so if you already did the solutions that are individually the silver and lead, you do not need to do any more tests with the known solutions. Although, if there was time and you were at all curious, it might be worthwhile to try it with the combination lead-silver solution. Otherwise, if you've already done the two individual solutions, then next move on to doing your unknown, which I will pass out the unknowns today. There is another batch that's available. There are going to be three different unknowns. I'm going to be putting them in beakers labeled 1, 2, and 3. Please make sure that you write down that unknown number, because you likely will not be graded on whether or not your results are correct once we finally turn in this lab report, but I want to at least see what you got. So I'll be passing those out. Pretend, again, that there's the mercury there, so we do all the tests. And the unknowns, maybe they've got both mercury and silver. Maybe they've just got mercury. Maybe they've got silver. Yes, of course, we know if we look it up in our book, but I purposely don't want to know, so there's some mystery left. All the waste is going to go into a common waste bucket, which right now it's in the back leftmost container in fume hood H4, where we normally had been putting our waste. The little containers that the unknown samples come in, those can also be disposed of in those same waste containers. And when you handle those containers, you might want to wear gloves, because you're assuming or presuming there's the possibility of silver being present, and you don't want to make a mess of yourself by having that stuff leak out accidentally from one of those little containers. Any last questions at all about lab? If you do finish your cations early today, then you just get to go home a little bit early.